giving off very strong signals, even if not followed by the shock. Condal, working with Tom Carew, a physiological psychologist, next showed that the snails could develop both short- and long-term memories. In one experiment, the team trained a snail to withdraw its gill after they'd touched it 10 times. The changes in the neurons remained for several minutes, the equivalent of a short-term memory. When they touched the gill 10 times in 4 different training sessions, separated from one another by several hours to one day, the changes in the neurons lasted as long as 3 weeks. The animals developed primitive long-term memories. Condal next worked with his colleague, the molecular biologist James Schwartz, and geneticists to better understand the individual molecules that are involved in forming long-term memories in the snails. They showed that in the snails, for short-term memories to become long-term, a new protein had to be made in the cell. The team showed that a short-term memory becomes long-term when a chemical in the neuron, called protein kinase A, moves from the body of the neuron into its nucleus, where genes are stored. The protein turns on a gene to make a protein that alters the structure of the nerve ending, so that it grows new connections between the neurons. Then, Condal, Carew, and colleagues Mary Chan and Craig Bailey showed that when a single neuron develops a long-term memory for a sensitization, it might go from having 1,300 to 2,700 synaptic connections, a staggering amount of neuroplastic change. The same process occurs in humans. When we learn, we alter which genes in our neurons are expressed or turned on. Our genes have 2 functions. The first, the template function, allows our genes to replicate, making copies of themselves that are passed from generation to generation. The template function is beyond our control. The second is the transcription function. Each cell in our body contains all our genes, but not all those genes are turned on or expressed. When a gene is turned on, it makes a new protein that alters the structure and function of the cell. This is called the transcription function, because when the gene is turned on, information about how to make these proteins is transcribed or read from the individual gene. This transcription function is influenced by what we do and think. Most people assume that our genes shape us, our behavior, and our brain anatomy. Condal's work shows that when we learn, our minds also affect which genes in our neurons are transcribed. Thus, we can shape our genes, which in turn shape our brain's microscopic anatomy. Condal argues that when psychotherapy changes people, it presumably does so through learning, by producing changes in gene expression that alter the strength of synaptic connections, and structural changes that alter the anatomical pattern of interconnections between nerve cells of the brain. Psychotherapy works by going deep into the brain and its neurons and changing their structure by turning on the right genes. Psychiatrist Dr. Susan Vaughn has argued that the talking cure works by talking to neurons, and that an effective psychotherapist or psychoanalyst is a microsurgeon of the mind who helps patients make needed alterations in neuronal networks. These discoveries about learning and memory at the molecular level have their roots in Condal's own history. Condal was born in 1929 in Vienna, a city of great cultural and intellectual richness. But Condal was a Jew, and Austria at the time was a virulently anti-Semitic country. In March 1938, when Hitler rolled into Vienna, annexing Austria to the German Reich, he was welcomed by adoring crowds, and the Catholic Archbishop of Vienna ordered all the churches to fly the Nazi flag. The next day, all Condal's classmates, except for one girl, the only other Jew in the class, stopped talking to him and began to bully him. By April, all Jewish children had been expelled from the school. On November 9, 1938, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass when the Nazis destroyed all the synagogues in the German Reich, including Austria, they arrested Condal's father. Austrian Jews were evicted from their homes, and 30,000 Jewish men were sent to concentration camps the following day. Condal wrote, "I remember Kristallnacht even today. More than 60 years later, almost as if it were yesterday. It fell 2 days after my 9th birthday, on which I was showered with toys from my father's shop. When we returned to our apartment a week or so after having been evicted, everything of value was gone, including my toys. It is probably futile, even for someone trained in psychoanalytic thinking, as I am, to attempt to trace the complex interests and actions of my later life to a few selected experiences of my youth. Nevertheless, I cannot help but think that the experiences of my last year in Vienna helped to determine my later interests in the mind, in how people behave, the unpredictability of motivation, and the persistence of memory. I am struck, as others have been, at how deeply these traumatic events of my childhood became burned into my memory. He was drawn to psychoanalysis because he believed it outlined by far the most coherent, interesting, and nuanced view of the human mind, and, of all the psychologies, had the most comprehensive understanding of the contradictions of human behavior, of how civilized societies could suddenly release such great viciousness in so many people, and of how a country as seemingly civilized as Austria could become so radically dissociated. Psychoanalysis, or analysis, is a treatment that helps people who are deeply troubled not only by symptoms but by aspects of their own character. These problems occur when we have powerful internal conflicts in which, as Condell says, parts of ourselves become radically dissociated or cut off from the rest of us. Whereas Condell's career took him from the clinic to the neuroscience laboratory, Sigmund Freud began his career as a laboratory neuroscientist. But because he was too impoverished to continue, he went in the opposite direction and became a neurologist in private practice, in order to have a sufficient income to support a family. One of his first endeavors was to fuse what he had learned about the brain as a neuroscientist with what he was learning about the mind while treating patients. As a neurologist, Freud quickly became disenchanted with the localizationism of the time, which was based on the work of Broca and others, and realized that the notion of the hardwired brain did not adequately explain how complex, culturally acquired mental activities such as reading and writing are possible. In 1891, he wrote a book titled On Aphasia, which showed the flaws in the existing evidence for one function, one location, and proposed that complex mental phenomena such as reading and writing are not restricted to distinct cortical areas, and that it made no sense to argue, as localizationists had, that there is a brain center for literacy, since literacy is not innate. Rather, the brain in the course of our individual lives must dynamically reorganize itself and its wiring to perform such culturally acquired functions. In 1895, Freud completed the Project for a Scientific Psychology, one of the first comprehensive neuroscientific models to integrate brain and mind, still admired for its sophistication. Here, Freud proposed the synapse, several years before Sir Charles Sherrington, who bears the credit. In the project, Freud even gave a description of how synapses, which he called contact barriers, might be changed by what we learn, anticipating Condell's work. He also began proposing neuroplastic ideas. The first plastic concept Freud developed is the law that neurons that fire together wire together, usually called Hebb's Law, though Freud proposed it in 1888, 60 years before Hebb. Freud stated that when two neurons fire simultaneously, this firing facilitates their ongoing association. Freud emphasized that what linked neurons was their firing together in time, and he called this phenomenon the law of association by simultaneity. The law of association explains the importance of Freud's idea of free association, in which psychoanalytic patients lie on the couch and free associate or say everything that comes into their minds, regardless of how uncomfortable or trivial it seems. The analyst sits behind the patient, out of the patient's sight, and usually says little. Freud found that if he didn't interfere, many warded-off feelings and interesting connections emerged in the patient's associations, thoughts and feelings the patient normally pushed away. Free association is based on the understanding that all our mental associations, even seemingly random ones that appear to make no sense, are expressions of links formed in our memory networks. His law of association by simultaneity implicitly links changes in neuronal networks with changes in our memory networks, so that neurons that fired together years before wired together, and these original connections are often still in place and show up in a patient's free associations. Freud's second plastic idea was that of the psychological critical period and the related idea of sexual plasticity. As we saw in Chapter 4, Acquiring Tastes and Loves, Freud was the first to argue that human sexuality and the ability to love have critical periods in early childhood that he called phases of organization. What happens during these critical periods has an inordinate effect on our ability to love and relate later in life. If something goes awry, it is possible to make changes later in life, but plastic change is much harder to achieve after a critical period closes. Freud's third idea was a plastic view of memory. The idea Freud inherited from his teachers was that events we experience can leave permanent memory traces in our minds. But when he started working with patients, he observed that memories are not written down once or engraved to remain unchanged forever, but can be altered by subsequent events and retranscribed. Freud observed that events could take on an altered meaning for patients years after they occurred, and that patients then altered their memories of those events. Children who were molested when very young and unable to understand what was being done to them were not always upset at the time, and their initial memories were not always negative. But once they matured sexually, they looked upon the incident anew and gave it new meaning, and their memory of the molestation changed. In 1896, Freud wrote that from time to time memory traces are subjected to a rearrangement in accordance with fresh circumstances to a retranscription. Thus, what is essentially new about my theory is the thesis that memory is present not once, but several times over. Memories are constantly remodeled, analogous in every way to the process by which a nation constructs legends about its early history. To be changed, Freud argued, memories had to be conscious and become the focus of our conscious attention, as neuroscientists have since shown. Unfortunately, as was the case with Mr. L., certain traumatic memories of events that happened early in childhood are not easily accessible to consciousness, so they don't change. Freud's fourth neuroplastic idea helped explain how it might be possible to make unconscious traumatic memories conscious and retranscribe them. He observed that in the mild sensory deprivation created by his sitting out of the patient's view and commenting only when he had insights into their problems, patients began to regard him as they had important people in their past, usually their parents, especially in their critical psychological periods. It was as though the patients were reliving past memories without being aware of it. Freud called this unconscious phenomenon transference, because patients were transferring scenes and ways of perceiving from the past onto the present. They were reliving them instead of remembering them. An analyst who is out of view and says little becomes a blank screen on which the patient begins to project his transference. Freud discovered that patients projected these transferences not only onto him, but onto other people in their lives without being aware of doing so, and that viewing others in a distorted way often got them into difficulty. Helping patients understand their transferences allowed them to improve their relationships. Most important, Freud discovered that transferences of early traumatic scenes could often be altered if he pointed out to the patient what was happening when the transference was activated and the patient was paying close attention. Thus, the underlying neuronal networks and the associated memories could be retranscribed and changed. At 26 months, the age at which Mr. L. lost his mother, the child's plastic change is at its height. New brain systems are forming and strengthening neural connections, and maps are differentiating and completing their basic structure with the help of stimulation from and interaction with the world. The right hemisphere has just completed a growth spurt, and the left hemisphere is beginning a spurt of its own. The right hemisphere generally processes nonverbal communication. It allows us to recognize faces and read facial expressions, and it connects us to other people. It thus processes the nonverbal visual cues exchanged between a mother and her baby. It also processes the musical component of speech, or tone, by which we convey emotion. During the right hemisphere's growth spurt, from birth until the second year, these functions undergo critical periods. The left hemisphere generally processes the verbal linguistic elements of speech, as opposed to the emotional, musical ones, and analyzes problems using conscious processing. Babies have a larger right hemisphere up to the end of the second year, and because the left hemisphere is only beginning its growth spurt, our right hemisphere dominates the brain for the first 3 years of our lives. 26-month-olds are complex, right-brained emotional creatures, but cannot talk about their experiences, a left brain function. Brain scans show that during the first 2 years of life, the mother principally communicates non-verbally with her right hemisphere to reach her infant's right hemisphere. A particularly important critical period lasts from approximately 10 or 12 months to 16 or 18 months, during which a key area of the right frontal lobe is developing and shaping the brain circuits that will allow infants both to maintain human attachments and to regulate their emotions. This maturing area, the part of the brain behind our right eye, is called the right orbital frontal system. The orbital frontal system has its central area in the orbital frontal cortex, which was discussed in Chapter 6, Brain Lock Unlocked. But the system includes links to the limbic system, which processes emotion. This system allows us both to read people's facial expressions and hence their emotions, and also to understand and control our own emotions. Little L at 26 months would have finished orbitofrontal development, but would not have had the opportunity to reinforce it. A mother who is with her baby during the critical period for emotional development and attachment is constantly teaching her child what emotions are by using musical speech and nonverbal gestures. When she looks at her child who swallowed some air with her milk, she might say, "There, there, honey, you look so upset. Don't be frightened. Your tummy hurts because you ate too fast. Let mommy burp you and give you a hug and you'll feel all right." She is telling the child the name of the emotion, fright, that it has a trigger, she ate too fast, that the emotion is communicated by facial expression, you look so upset, that it is associated with a bodily sensation, a tummy cramp, and that turning to others for relief is often helpful. Let mommy burp you and give you a hug. That mother has given her child a crash course in the many aspects of emotion conveyed not only with words, but with the loving music of her voice and the reassurance of her gestures and touch. For children to know and regulate their emotions and be socially connected, they need to experience this kind of interaction many hundreds of times in the critical period and then to have it reinforced later in life. Mr. L. lost his mother only a few months after he completed development of his orbital frontal system. So it fell on others, who were themselves grieving and probably less attuned to him than his mother would have been, to help him use and exercise his orbital frontal system, lest it begin to weaken. The child who loses his mother at this young age is almost always struck two devastating blows. He loses his mother to death and the surviving parent to depression. If others cannot help him soothe himself and regulate his own emotions as his mother did, he learns to auto-regulate by turning off his emotions. When Mr. L. sought treatment, he still had this tendency to turn emotions off and trouble maintaining attachments. Long before brain scans of the orbital frontal cortex were possible, psychoanalysts had observed the characteristics of children deprived of mothering in early critical periods. During World War II, René Spitz studied infants reared by their own mothers in prison, comparing them with those reared in a foundling home, where one nurse was responsible for 7 infants. The foundling infants stopped developing intellectually, were unable to control their emotions, and instead rocked endlessly back and forth, or made strange hand movements. They also entered turned-off states and were indifferent to the world, unresponsive to people who tried to hold and comfort them. In photographs, these infants have a haunting, faraway look in their eyes. The turned-off or paralytic states occur when children give up all hope of finding their lost parent again. But how could Mr. L, who entered similar states, have registered such early experiences in his memory? Neuroscientists recognize two major memory systems. Both are plastically altered in psychotherapy. The well-developed memory system in 26-month-old children is called procedural or implicit memory. These terms are often used interchangeably by Condal. Procedural implicit memory functions when we learn a procedure or group of automatic actions occurring outside our focused attention in which words are generally not required. Our nonverbal interactions with people and many of our emotional memories are part of our procedural memory system. As Condal says, during the first 2 to 3 years of life, when an infant's interaction with its mother is particularly important, the infant relies primarily on its procedural memory systems. Procedural memories are generally unconscious. Riding a bike depends on procedural memory. And most people who ride easily would have trouble consciously explaining precisely how they do it. The procedural memory system confirms that we can have unconscious memories, as Freud proposed. The other form of memory is called explicit or declarative memory, which is just beginning to develop in the 26-month-old. Explicit memory consciously recollects specific facts, events, and episodes. It is the memory we use when we describe and make explicit what we did on the weekend and with whom and for how long. It helps us to organize our memories by time and place. Explicit memory is supported by language and becomes more important once children can talk. People who have been traumatized in their first 3 years can be expected to have few, if any, explicit memories of their traumas. Mr. L. said he had not a single memory of his first 4 years. But procedural implicit memories for these traumas exist and are commonly evoked or triggered when people get into situations that are similar to the trauma. Such memories often seem to come at us out of the blue and do not seem to be classified by time, place, and context the way most explicit memories are. Procedural memories of emotional interactions often get repeated in transference or in life. Explicit memory was discovered through observation of the most famous memory case in neuroscience, a young man named H.M., who had had severe epilepsy. To treat it, his doctors cut out a part of his brain the size of the human thumb, the hippocampus. There are actually 2 hippocampi, one in each hemisphere, and both were removed. After surgery, H.M. at first seemed normal. He recognized his family and could conduct conversations. But it was soon apparent that since his operation he could not learn any new facts. When his doctors visited him, chatted, left, and then returned again, he had no memory whatsoever of the previous meeting. We learn from H.M.'s case that the hippocampus turns our short-term explicit memories into long-term explicit memories for people, places, and things, the memories to which we have conscious access. Analysis helps patients put their unconscious procedural memories and actions into words and into context so they can better understand them. In the process, they plastically retranscribe these procedural memories so that they become conscious explicit memories, sometimes for the first time, and patients no longer need to relive or reenact them, especially if they were traumatic. Mr. L. took quickly to analysis and free association and started to find, as many patients do, that dreams from the night before often came to mind. Soon he began reporting his recurring dream about searching for an unidentified object, but added new details. The object might be a person. The lost object may be part of me, maybe not, maybe a toy, possession, or a person. I absolutely must have it. I will know it when I find it. Yet sometimes I am not sure it existed at all, and hence I am unsure anything was lost. I pointed out to him that a pattern was emerging. He reported not only these dreams, but also his depression and feelings of paralysis after holidays that interrupted our work. At first he didn't believe me, but the depressions and the dreams of loss, possibly of a person, continued to appear at breaks. Then he remembered that interruptions at work also led to mysterious depressions. The thought in his dream of desperately searching were associated in his memory with interruptions of his care, and the neurons encoding these memories were presumably wired together early in his development. But he was no longer consciously aware, if he ever was, of this past link. The lost toy in the dream was the clue that his current suffering was colored by childhood losses. But the dream implied that the loss was happening now. Past and present were being mixed up together, and a transference was being activated. At this point, I, as an analyst, did what an attuned mother does when she develops the orbitofrontal system, pointing out emotional basics, helping him name his emotions, their triggers, and how they influenced his mental and bodily states. Soon he was able to spot the triggers and emotions himself. The interruptions evoked three different types of procedural memories: an anxious state in which he was pining and searching for his lost mother and family, a depressed state in which he despaired of finding what he sought, and a paralyzed state when he turned off and time stood still, probably because he was totally overwhelmed. By talking about these experiences, he was able for the first time in his adult life to connect his desperate searching with its true trigger, the loss of a person, and to realize that his mind and brain still fused the idea of separation with the idea of his mother's death. Making these connections and also realizing that he was no longer a helpless child, he felt less overwhelmed. In neuroplastic terms, activating and paying close attention to the link between everyday separations and his catastrophic response to them allowed him to unwire the connection and alter the pattern. As Mr. L. became aware that he was reacting to our short separations as though they were major losses, he had the following dream. "I'm with a man moving a big wooden box with a weight in it." When he freely associated to the dream, several thoughts came to mind. The box reminded him of his toy box, but also of a coffin. The dream seemed to be saying in symbolic images that he was carrying around the weight of his mother's death. Then the man in the dream said, "Look at what you paid for this box. I start disrobing, and my leg is in bad condition, scarred, covered with scabs, and healed with a protuberance that is a dead part of me. I didn't know the price would be this high." The words, "I didn't know the price would be this high," were linked in his mind to a growing realization that he was still influenced by his mother's death. He had been wounded and was still scarred. Right after articulating that thought, he grew silent and had one of the major epiphanies of his life. "Whenever I am with a woman," he said, "I soon think that she is not the one for me, and I imagine that some other ideal woman is out there somewhere waiting." Then, sounding utterly shocked, he said, "I just realized that that other woman seems to be some vague sense of my mother that I had as a child, and it is she that I must be faithful to, but whom I never find. The woman I am with becomes my adoptive mother, and loving her is betraying my real mother." He suddenly realized that his urge to cheat had occurred just as he was getting closer to his wife, threatening his buried tie to his mother. His infidelity was always in the service of a higher but unconscious fidelity. This revelation was also the first hint that he had registered some kind of attachment to his mother. When I next wondered aloud whether he might be experiencing me as the man in his dream who pointed out how damaged he felt, Mr. L. burst into tears for the first time in his adult life. Mr. L. did not get better all at once. He had first to experience cycles of separations, dreams, depressions, and insights, the repetition or working through required for long-term neuroplastic change. New ways of relating had to be learned, wiring new neurons together, and old ways of responding had to be unlearned, weakening neuronal links. Because Mr. L. had linked the ideas of separation and death, they were wired together in his neuronal networks. Now that he was conscious of his association, he could unlearn it. We all have defense mechanisms, really reaction patterns, that hide unbearably painful ideas, feelings, and memories from conscious awareness. One of these defenses is called dissociation, which keeps threatening ideas or feelings separated from the rest of the psyche. In analysis, Mr. L. began to have opportunities to re-experience painful autobiographical memories of searching for his mother that had been frozen in time and dissociated from his conscious memories. Each time he did so, he felt more whole as neuronal groups encoding his memories that had been disconnected were connected. Psychoanalysts since Freud have noted that some patients in analysis develop powerful feelings toward the analyst. This happened in Mr. L.'s case. A certain warmth and positive sense of closeness developed between us. Freud thought that these powerful positive transference feelings became one of the many engines that promoted the cure. In neuroscientific terms, this probably helps because emotions and the patterns we display in relationships are part of the procedural memory system. When such patterns are triggered in therapy, it gives the patient a chance to look at them and change them. For as we saw in Chapter 4, Acquiring Tastes and Loves, positive bonds appear to facilitate neuroplastic change by triggering unlearning and dissolving existing neuronal networks, so the patient can alter his existing intentions. There is no longer any doubt, writes Condell, that psychotherapy can result in detectable changes in the brain. Recent brain scans done before and after psychotherapy show both that the brain plastically reorganizes itself in treatment, and that the more successful the treatment, the greater the change. When patients relive their traumas and have flashbacks and uncontrollable emotions, the flow of blood to the prefrontal and frontal lobes, which help regulate our behavior, decreases, indicating that these areas are less active. According to neuropsychoanalyst Mark Solms and neuroscientist Oliver Turnbull, the aim of the talking cure, from the neurobiological point of view, is to extend the functional sphere of influence of the prefrontal lobes. A study of depressed patients treated with interpersonal psychotherapy, a short-term treatment that is partially based on the theoretical work of two psychoanalysts, John Bowlby and Harry Stack Sullivan, showed that prefrontal brain activity normalized with treatment. The right orbitofrontal system, which is so important in recognizing and regulating emotions and relationships, a function that was disturbed in Mr. L., is part of the prefrontal cortex. A more recent fMRI brain scan study of anxious patients with panic disorder found that the tendency of their limbic systems to be abnormally activated by potentially threatening stimuli was reduced following psychoanalytic psychotherapy. As Mr. L. began to understand his post-traumatic symptoms, he began regulating his emotions better. He reported that outside the analysis he had more self-control. His mysterious paralytic states decreased. When he had painful feelings, he didn't resort to drinking nearly as often. Now Mr. L. began to let down his guard and became less defensive. He was more comfortable expressing anger when called for and felt closer to his children. Increasingly, he used his sessions to face his pain instead of turning it off completely. Now Mr. L. slipped into long silences that had a profoundly resolute quality. His facial expression showed that he was in extraordinary pain, feeling an awful sadness that he wouldn't discuss. Because his feelings about his mother's loss were not talked about while he was growing up, and the family dealt with its pain by getting on with chores, and because he had been silent for so long, I took a risk and tried to put what he was conveying non-verbally into words. I said, "It's as though you were saying to me, as perhaps you once wanted to say to your family, 'Can't you see? After this terrible loss, I have to be depressed right now.'" He burst into tears for the second time in analysis. He started involuntarily and rhythmically to protrude his tongue between weeping spells, making him look like a baby from whom the breast had been withdrawn and who was protruding his tongue to find it. Then he covered his face, put his hand in his mouth like a 2-year-old, and broke out into loud, primitive sobbing. He said, "I want to be consoled for my pains and losses, yet don't come too close to console me. I want to be alone in my sullen misery, which you can't understand because I can't understand. It's a grief that is too big." Hearing this, we both became aware that he often took the stance of rejecting consolation and that it contributed to the remoteness of his character. He was working through a defense mechanism that had been in place since childhood and that helped him block off the immensity of his loss. That defense, by being repeated many thousands of times, had been plastically reinforced. This most pronounced of his character traits, his remoteness, wasn't genetically predetermined, but plastically learned, and now it was being unlearned. It may seem unusual that Mr. L. wept and stuck out his tongue like a baby, but it was the first of several such infantile experiences that he would have on the couch. Freud observed that patients who have had early traumas will often, at key moments, regress, to use his term, and not only remember early memories, but briefly experience them in childlike ways. This makes perfect sense from a neuroplastic point of view. Mr. L. had just given up a defense that he had used since childhood, the denial of the emotional impact of his loss, and it exposed the memories and emotional pain that the defense had hidden. Recall that Bacharita described something very similar happening in patients undergoing brain reorganization. If an established brain network is blocked, then older networks in place long before the established one must be used. He called this the unmasking of older neuronal paths and thought it one of the chief ways the brain reorganizes itself. Regression in analysis at a neuronal level is, I believe, an instance of unmasking, which often precedes psychological reorganization. That is what followed for Mr. L. In his next session, he reported that his recurring dream had changed. This time, he went to visit his old house looking for adult possessions. The dream signaled that the part of him that had been deadened was coming alive again.
This is the end of disc number 7. Please insert disc number 8.